Show a lot. I really encourage all of you to call us. Arguing is good. Disagreeing is good. Being respectful is good. It's a good idea to participate at every level in restructuring, rebuilding, and correcting the horrors that exist today. Thank you very much for the calls.
From those nads in Tiananmen Square, it's coming from the field.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 10 o'clock, it's Chris Andre, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Law & Disorder investigates Trump's financial ties to Russian oligarchs, plus former CIA analyst Ray McGovern explains the deep state's role in hacking during the presidential campaign. At 11 on stage and studio, D'Mae Roberts welcomes Devin Allen, who stars in a new production of Good With People at Performance Workshops Northwest. Then a preview of D'Mae's new documentary, Crossing East, Relations, about the historic relationship between Black and Asian Americans. And at 11:30, On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital with reports from Gerald Horn on the Manchester bombing, Libya, and the Supreme Court's ruling voting rights decision. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And please stay tuned for Alternative Radio. Camille Paglia speaks on Free Women, Free Men, a look at different currents and tendencies within the feminist movement.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. This year, the festival will be held June 30th through July 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Festival passes are on sale now, including the Blues Buddy Pass and the basic 5-day pass at early bird prices. More information about the passes, the festival, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2017.
Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m. for another special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. Once again, we'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival, with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and the participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive and entertaining festival. Again, be sure to tune in on Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m. for our What the Festival broadcast. More information can be found on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Check it out, baby.
I've launched an attack, for example, on Sheryl Sandberg as incredibly smugly entitled, talking about, you know, leaning in while at the same time concealing from sight all of those servants that she has and the nannies that she has, okay, who are you know, working class people who are supporting her particular very public lifestyle. We need a much more enlightened feminism. I think that most men are in favor of women rising in society and being in charge in society. We're no longer in the antediluvian old days. So I want men to recover a sense of who they are as men again, okay, and not feel they have to obey any checklist being issued by Gloria Steinem and company, you know, in Manhattan.
That's Camille Paglia. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Camille Paglia on Free Women, Free Men. The feminist movement, in its various forms, posed a genuine challenge to patriarchy, male domination. Privilege among most men was seen as a right, the way things were. Within the feminist movement, there were different currents and tendencies. Its accomplishments were myriad, but there is still much work to be done. Misogyny, hostility, sexual commodification, harassment, and violence against women persist. There is still a gender wage gap. Women working full-time in nearly every single occupation earn only 80% of what men do. gender categories and sexual orientations and the stereotypes embedded in them have undergone a radical shift in recent years. Feminism and the women's movement are still seen as a threat by some, particularly among more conservative, religious-minded people. Tearing down the old ways of thinking and behavior sometimes leads to confusion, tension, and cultural conflict. It doesn't have to be that way. Our guest today is Camille Paglia. She's University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. She's a regular contributor to Salon.com and the author of such books as Vamps and Tramps and Free Women, Free Men. She spoke at the Seattle Public Central Library. And now, Camille Paglia.
Now, my premier principles as a person and as a thinker are free thought and free speech. I am truly a child of the 1960s in that respect. And I am totally opposed to any kind of curtailment of either of those two things for whatever laudable social causes anyone may think that they have. My particular wing of feminism was suppressed for many years. My feminism predates second wave feminism, which was created by Betty Friedan with her co-founding of Now in 1966. I was already a feminist because I was directly impacted by first wave feminism in the early 1960s. When 1961, when I was 14 years old, I suddenly became obsessed with Amelia Earhart after an article about yet another, clue was found, whatever it was, that was in the Syracuse Herald Journal. And I embarked on a 3-year research project in high school into Amelia Earhart. I went to all kinds of places. I ransacked the old newspapers and in the bowels of the Syracuse Library and so on. And also, I was obsessed with Katharine Hepburn, whom I saw on late night TV. What I was getting from Katharine Hepburn, I did not realize for decades, was actually the real flame of first wave feminism, because her mother was the head of the Connecticut Woman Suffrage Organization. Her aunt was also a campaigner for women suffrage, and Hepburn herself campaigned as a small child with balloons and at protests, votes for women, votes for women, etc. Right? So I was getting this first impact of 1920s, 1930s, after women had just won the right to vote in 1920. We wanted to reproduce in my new book the actual page from Newsweek magazine in 1963, the letters to the editor, where I was given the lead letter to the editor when the Soviets launched Valentina Tereshkova into space. She was the first woman to enter space at a time when women were banned from the American space program. And I wrote a protest letter. I was 16 years old. This is before Now, was ever founded. I said that this happened. She went into space on the very anniversary, 35th anniversary, whatever it was, of Amelia Earhart flying the Atlantic. And I said, it's obvious that Miss Earhart's, quest for equal opportunity for American women still remains to be won. So I was already a feminist. Before all this happened in the late 1960s, then I tried to join the women's movement. It did not succeed because the women's movement had all kinds of preconceptions about the suppression of speech. They were anti-rock and roll, anti-art, go down the line. I was one of the, what we later would call pro-sex feminist. Right? So in the, 1970s, for example, I loved Charlie's Angels. I loved Cosmopolitan magazine. I loved Scavullo's covers. Meanwhile, the other feminists were like occupying Helen Gurley Brown's offices and wanting the whole magazine to be shut down, etc. Right? I loved the Bond girls, the James Bond girls, or Ursula Andress coming out of the water with her white bikini. Right? So I loved the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. There's no way I could be taken into the women's movement. I was drummed right out of it, right from the start. I was not made, by Betty Friedan. Betty Friedan did not create Germaine Greer in Australia, and she did not create me in upstate New York, right? And it's about time people realize the transformations in women that happened very radically in the mid-20th century are not entirely due to the women's movement, right? So what happened was Madonna, Madonna was so important important. I mean, the way Madonna is behaving now, it's such an embarrassment, all right, because the current Madonna bears no resemblance to the pioneering Madonna of the 1980s and 90s, but she will live forever for what she did. The pro-sex feminist movement of the 1990s was made possible by Madonna's trifling with pornography and exposure of the body and so on, and her brilliant videos of the 80s and 90s. I believe they are truly works of art, all right? Her great period was 1983 to 1992. Okay, so at any rate, it's all of a sudden this long silenced wing of feminism, the pro-sex wing, burst forth, okay, in the 1990s. There was Feminists for Free Expression, for example, that I was allied with. What we were fighting against was the horrible scourge of political correctness and suppression of free thought and free speech. During the 1980s, in the anti-porn movement led by Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, okay, the fanatics, okay, and those women, they wrote an ordinance, which was indeed adopted by Minneapolis and Indianapolis, to shut down even the sale of men's magazines in those towns, like almost Playboy and Penthouse and so on the grounds that supposedly pornography caused violence against women, caused rape, caused murder, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? These women were deranged, okay, truly deranged women, but they ruled the 1980s in feminism. So then, thanks to Madonna, my pro-sex wing of feminism rose up, okay? It also was helped along by the lipstick lesbians of San Francisco. There was like a cell of them, okay, sort of black leather, you know, lesbians and so on. Okay? So then we went national, and I thought, oh, now we've won. Okay, there's no problem. But now I have to go back on the road. Okay, 23 years later, I have to return. Okay, all of a sudden we've gone full circle again. Okay, this horrible scourge, you know, of political correctness is back, even worse. Okay, we have people rioting and smashing windows at Berkeley. Okay, the place, you know, the capital, okay, of the free speech movement and so on. Okay, so here I am again. Okay. I'm not happy about it. Now, I'm calling for an end to the sex war, okay, in feminism. Okay, women are well launched now. Okay, so this reflex, snide, put downs of men that are everywhere. This has got to stop. Right? Now, I notice, wherever I go in the world, actually, that upper middle class career women are very unhappy. They're very unhappy, okay, even though they have achieved a certain status. What I'm saying is that feminists have to stop blaming men for their own unhappiness. The unhappiness is due, I believe, to huge systemic changes that women, for thousands of years, women had their own world. There was the world of women, and there was the world of men. And the sexes didn't have that much to do with each other, okay? This is a brand new experiment to have this new system where now women can be economically independent now. They're no longer dependent on father or husband or brother, okay, for their sustenance, right? And they're working side by side with men in the workplace, right? This is an experiment. It's never happened before, right? We may have to accept a certain amount of tension between the sexes in the workplace. Right? The feminist idea that if we can just suppress men enough, women will be happy. I say no. Okay? I say, okay, and it's on the basis of my own experience as a child in an Italian-American immigrant community, okay, is that what women have lost is the old solidarity that they once had when they totally ruled the private sphere. A women's life all day long was with other women once, multi-generational, older women, okay, as well as the children, right? It was a huge tribal experience. And now what women are feeling is a sense of isolation and loneliness, disconnection, okay, from their old function. I'm not saying to go back. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying stop blaming men, all right? Like, for example, these marches that just happened, okay? The women were exhilarated. They were almost hysterical, okay? I don't think it had anything to do with feminism or anti-Trump or anything like that. I thought it was that women suddenly felt that surge of happiness again for being with other women, all right? All right? You can actually see it in the Odyssey when Odysseus is washed up naked and alone. He's lost his ship, you know, on the shores of Phaeacia. And he wakes to the sound of girls, women's voices, laughing and singing and so on. It's the Princess Nausicaa going down to do the laundry on the shore, okay? And actually, that is exactly what was going on up until fairly recently, where women were all together. They did all the chores together. They did the laundry. They did the cooking. I mean, I can remember this from my childhood in Endicott, New York, upstate New York, among the immigrants. Italian women. All four of my grandparents, plus my mother, were born in Italy. So I actually had that experience, the experience that went on for thousands of years in the agrarian era. Women all together. In fact, my mother described as a small child in Italy how all the women would get together to do the laundry and go up the hill to Il Sorgo, which was a fountain cut out of the side of the mountain, probably went back thousands of years to the Roman period and so on. She remembered the singing, the picnicking, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so even though people were laboring physically in the agrarian era, there was a happiness, okay, a sense of identity. There was no quest for identity. Now it's no place for an independent thinker. Okay, if you were an independent thinker, you had no options as a woman except to become a nun. Okay, so I know I would have been a nun. Okay, 100 years ago. And obviously, communities are intellectually repressive, in their own way. Nevertheless, we're in a period now of quest for identity, tremendous pressures on young people to form their own identity separate from those old automatic tribal and community affiliations. So I think there's a tremendous, as a classroom teacher, of now, more than 40 years, I can see this. And it's really, there's a tremendous sense of psychological dislocation among young people. And they find many ways to try to achieve some sorts of identity. And part of it right now, of course, is social media, which is causing the total, entropy in terms of ability to reason, to read, to write, the old things. So on. All right. Now, I'm also calling for an end to this insanity of excluding biology, from gender studies. Now, how in the world did this happen? Right? How did women's studies and gender studies end up teaching about gender without any reference whatever to biology or to hormones? Right? And right now, post-structuralism dominates gender studies everywhere. Now, I spent 6 months writing my dissection of Foucault. Okay, what is that? 27 years ago. Now, assignment. Hello, anyone who thinks that Foucault is somehow, the master of the universe has clearly not read my exposure of him in Junk Bonds and Corporate Raiders. I mean, the man was a fraud. I'm sorry. The post-structuralists pose as leftists. But what were they doing in the past few decades with this crazy parasitic growth of this administrator master class, okay, that has taken over the universities, right, at a period of obscene, rise in tuition costs, student debt that's crippling families and so on. Where were these leftists, the great leftists, on our college campuses, were they resisting the administrators, were they denouncing student debts, were they lamenting, the plight of adjunct teachers and so on? No, they were all running to conferences, talking about Foucault with their stupid elitist jargon. Okay, and you think they thought that's leftism? Okay, these post-structuralists are the worst mercenary careerists in this country. The leading post-structuralists and new historicists are retiring as multimillionaires. And they pose as leftists. Okay, it is a scandal. Forget Foucault, for heaven's sakes. It's absolutely absurd. Okay, so we have to bring biology, an authentic study of medicine, of anthropology, of history, back into gender studies. That's one thing I'm definitely calling for. Now, aside from these things, I'm on the warpath against the bureaucracy of the campuses. Okay, at Bennington College, my first job in the 1970s, we had an uprising. Okay, as faculty against the trustees and the administrators, the president of that college, and it was like huge publicized. Nora Ephron went up there and wrote it up for, you know, for Esquire magazine and so on. And the faculties are totally castrated. What are they doing? The faculties have absolutely been marginalized in this country. And they didn't utter a peep as this administrative masterclass took over. The administrators who are in league with federal, mandates or federal authorities in Washington. And again, the leftists have, they talk a big talk, okay? But they do nothing where it really matters, okay? Which is demand, 50% reduction in the number of administrators, okay? And also, 75% reduction in their salaries, okay, which often exceeds that of the faculty members. People should realize how many of the ills that I'm decrying about the suppression of speech and free thought on campus are coming from the administrators, who are these social welfare do-gooders. Oscar Wilde was absolutely scathing about these humanitarians, these aggressive philanthropists who dominated the Victorian period. There's a reprint of what I consider an important piece of mine in Time magazine, where I called for the end of this outrageous age 21 law in the United States, where young people cannot buy a beer. Nowhere in the world, except in very repressive regimes, like the United Arab Emirates and so on, is there anything like that? Okay. Mothers against drunk driving. They wandered into an area here that has been extremely destructive. When that rule was passed in 1984, okay, what did young people do, unable now to drink? Okay, they began taking the club drugs, of course, okay, ecstasy and ketamine and all this crap that they take into their bodies. And what's happened to the ability, of young people to go to a bar, learn how to drink in a sensible way in an adult context, be able to sit with the opposite sex? Learn how to talk, how to flirt, discuss ideas. It has absolutely a cruel law. No one has raised, you can buy marijuana in Colorado, right? And young people can't get a glass of beer, okay, when they arrive in college. Do you realize how outrageous that is? That has to end. Just to return to what I was saying about, the solidarity of women in the agrarian period. I think that probably part of my ability to analyze things comes from my exposure to almost a kind of a capsule condensed version of human history. I experienced the agrarian era through my contact with those powerful country women, who had immigrated, the power of the rural paradigm and the strength of Southern women and so on. But we were a whole town of us, really, from Italy, concentrated in this area of the Triple Cities in upstate New York because of the shoe factories, the Endicott Johnson shoe factories. So I then had a direct experience of the industrial era, which followed the agrarian era. My grandfather, everyone in the town, went to the factories, which dominated Endicott with the smokestacks in that period before environmental laws, the soot would be heavy, on windowsills. You could smell the tanning pools and so on. So I had the experience of the industrial era. And then my father, fresh out of the paratroopers in World War II, was able to go to college on the GI Bill. I was born while he was in college. My parents married at 20 and had me at 21. So he was like mopping the cafeteria floor, the only member of his large family to go to college. Then he became a high school teacher and then a professor at Lemoyne College in Syracuse. So we moved into the new service sector, economy, right? So I, in my own life, those women, the country women, were more powerful, okay, than any feminist, okay? They were physically powerful, literally, in that period before automatic washers and dryers. Everyone did laundry by hand. Okay? I can remember my grandmother washing on the back porch with a washboard, okay? They were powerful, like this, right? And these women had big voices, okay, and big attitudes, right? So, when my father was teaching high school in the small farming town of Oxford, New York, we lived for a year in the upper floor of a farmhouse, and there was like a hilarious moment. My father was out with his brother. They were standing outside smoking a cigarette, and suddenly the farm woman yelled at them. Okay, a calf had escaped from the barn, and she said, "Stop her!" Okay, to my father and my uncle, and the calf thundered by. My father and my uncle just stepped backwards as it went by, and the farm woman went, chased the calf, and came back carrying the calf, right? And as she's passed she said, "Men." Okay. Those were the women. For thousands of years, you know, country women had physical power and mental power, and they were the equals of men. In fact, it's no coincidence that the first states and territories to give women the right to vote were in the West, okay? That it was the pioneer areas, okay, where it was obvious that women were the equals of men. Whereas right to the very end, the educated states, the states where the great universities were, like, you know, Pennsylvania, New York State, Massachusetts, and so on, refused to grant women the right to vote. Not until the constitutional amendment was passed, you know, 1920. It's because the differential between the upper middle class man and upper middle class woman, okay, in the late 19th century and early 20th century was very profound, okay. A lady seemed to be a different entity, seemed to be far more emotional, tended to faint, you know, tended to be rather delicate, etc. All right, so the idea of granting such women, however admirable, you know, the right to vote, was not as easy as it was for the territories. Okay, why don't we just move to the question period then? Because I love the question period, and I'm sure you would too.
I realize that now, hearing you talk and everything, that this is kind of the result of the pendulum being swung very far to one end, and I was wondering if you thought that are we now at the point where a pendulum is about to swing back into a more kind of moderate, let's all actually do something together and treat each other as equals, all genders, all races kind of thing?
Well, I'm calling for men to take control again of their own lives. So I've said in a recent interview that if there's a women's center at Yale University, which there is for the undergraduates, then there should be a men's center. There should be absolute equality. And the men should be totally free to do whatever they want in their men's center. Okay? They can show dirty movies or whatever they want. Okay? This constantly beating down of men, okay, this demand that men redefine themselves until they suit what feminists want them to be, it's an outrage that civilization, with all of its protections and conveniences, is essentially the invention of men. Now, I explain that in my first book, Sexual Personae, by saying that woman's power is so enormous that men had to band together to go off and to create these objective structures. And I still think that my analysis of it is absolutely right. But it's men who are doing all of the, you know, the hardest and dirtiest work in society. There's a whole list of things. When there's an ice storm in the Northeast, it's the men who go out at 2 a.m. with the fall, the live wires and so on. I rarely see women, okay, going out at that hour. I never see women manning the great vats of tar in the heat of the summer that people are mixing to put on the roof, okay? I never see the women as I did last year, saw an enormous sewage break in a neighboring town where men in hazmat suits were up to their knees in wastewater, okay? Not a single woman wants to volunteer for that kind of work. People are still depending on men and keeping working class men invisible. I've launched an attack, for example, on Sheryl Sandberg, right? As incredibly smugly entitled, talking about, you know, leaning in while at the same time concealing from sight all of those servants that she has and the nannies that she has, okay, who are, you know, working class people who are supporting her particular very public lifestyle. I think in general, it's men are erased, the contributions of men are erased, and also the contributions of working class people are erased. And this has to stop, okay? It has to stop. We need a much more enlightened feminism. I think that most men are in favor of women rising in society and being in charge in society. We're no longer in the antediluvian old days. So I want men, okay, to recover a sense of who they are as men again, okay, and not feel they have to obey any list, okay, checklist being issued by Gloria Steinem and company in Manhattan.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you believe that sexism is relevant? Because you said that women have to stop blaming men for their unhappiness, and nowhere in there was a discussion of sexism in the workplace, that women are, like, treated as less smart, as less capable. And it seems to me that your words are sort of reinforcing this notion, especially in terms of the workplace.
Well, I am an equity feminist. That is, I believe in the removal of all advances to women's, all obstacles to women's advance in society in the professional and political realm. So absolutely, I'm very focused on any instance of workplace sexism. What I'm saying in my writing is that we are not simply what working individuals, right? There is a public side of our life and there is a private side of our life. In Sexual Personae, I talked about the psychological dream life of mankind. There are all kinds of primitive impulses in us that are very atavistic. Do we want to understand ourselves as human beings or what? Okay. We cannot simply define human beings in terms of what we are in the workplace or in the political realm. I believe that was actually the biggest legacy of the 1960s. 1960s were about turning away from materialistic careerism and embarking on a kind of cosmic quest for meaning in the universe. So I think that my work offers a kind of dual perspective. I'm talking about women's advance in society and what best helps that, and I'm also talking about our need as human beings to expand our imaginations. I have, even though I'm an atheist, I have a very spiritualistic view of the universe, and that is my particular vibration with Native American culture. That's in fact what I'm doing for the last 9 years, is trying to map, okay, the actual metaphysical religious perspective of the ancient Native Americans. I believe I'm that my views of things as represented in Sexual Personae are very much in vibe with that.
I can't remember which video it was, but you were talking about college education and you're fed up with the whole cafeteria style. I think you called it the invent your own major. You think
yes.
You should go back to a survey sort of, and I graduated from college several months ago, so I've never taken a survey course in my life, so I was hoping you could talk about what you think the benefit to that type of education would be.
Yes. I think that's been an absolute disaster what's happened in the last 30 years. I'm speaking as a career college teacher, which is this degeneration into the cafeteria menu, where young people arrive in college and say, you can take this or this or this or this or this or this. And then you have all these like kind of narrow courses being offered by professors who are basically teaching what they're interested in. I think that is not education at all. Okay. That the best kind of education gives the broad view. The abandonment of the great art history survey course has been a cultural disaster in this country, where it used to be you had two semesters, you would begin with cave art, the Stone Age, and move all the way down by the end of the second semester to abstract expressionism and modernism. Right? This gives a sense of the narrative of history. But of course, in postmodernism and poststructuralism, all narratives are false. Okay, everything, please. Okay, there is a narrative in history. There is. Okay, you know, I've talked about how the pillar forms, okay, created by Imhotep at the pyramid complex at Saqqara, okay, in Egypt, that can be seen 5,000 years later, okay, in our Corinthian columns and banks all over the United States and Europe and so on. People who deal with artifacts of archaeology and in history, can recognize the legacy and the continuity in cultural traditions. So I think that colleges need to be very stripped down. They need to be making decisions about how to about what they're going to teach. Now, I have been saying for 25 years that for me the best multiculturalism would be to teach comparative religion, the world religions, right, as a way to introduce students to the world, not just to the Western tradition, to the entire world. And if my plan had been followed, we wouldn't have a lot of the problems today in the incomprehension about Islam. People would already know about the sacred texts, okay? And would be able to discuss, okay, that this group, okay, is following these particular verses of the Quran. This group is doing that, and it wouldn't be this chaos which we have right now. And this period of secular humanism is an absolute failure. Absolute failure. Okay, young people, okay, are starved for meaning. That's why they're clinging to politics. But you cannot cling to politics. Politics and the social realm. This is minor. It's a minor part of human existence. existence. Okay, there's something much bigger, okay, much, much bigger, the universe. There are whole wells of deep meaning out there beyond the political realm. I'm not saying not to demand social reform. I'm not saying, you know, to cease to be progressive and to look for the most just human society possible. But I am saying that there is a kind of mania abroad right now, obsession, okay, with politics. This is a betrayal of the legacy of the 60s, a betrayal of the tremendous vision, the cosmic vision of the 1960s. And I've written about this. I believe that the reason for that is that the apostles of that particular spiritual quest of the 60s are lost to us because they took so much LSD, they never came back. That's the problem. They never wrote the books, which should have been the companion books to my own work. Thank you for your question.
You're listening to Camille Paglia, Free Women, Free Men. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What can male allies do to help alleviate the common situation of workplace sexism?
Well, I'm saying that a real man is honorable. A real man respects women. And that any man who abuses women or treats them in a denigrating fashion is showing weakness, a weakness that in fact comes from some inner sense that he has of woman's overwhelming power. So I'm calling for a mutual recognition, a mutual respect between the sexes, but I'm also calling for middle-class girls to stop asking for special protections. Again, I want equality of treatment in the workplace. But I think there's too much decrying of men's behavior when, in fact, what too many white upper-middle-class girls are bringing now, okay, to the workplace is a certain manner of speaking, okay, that is removed from the actual harshness of the world. That actually working class women, whether they come from the farmland or they come from the street, okay, understand the risks and dangers of the world. So some of the most controversial writing that I've done is about the need, okay, for women to be Amazon warriors for themselves. Okay, that is my philosophy is street smart feminism, okay, or Amazonism. That's why I pose with weapons in so many of my pictures. All right, it's up to women themselves to understand the dangers of the world, not expect the world to be an extension of their protected, comfortable middle class living room. And that's, I think, what's happened. I see women whose voices aren't strong enough. Women have to learn not to be embarrassed, okay, to be loud and to confront when it happens. I see too many cases of women who are dismayed by something which they feel is demeaning and who just accept it. All right? And that is not, no. The first time it happens, you speak out. You speak out. You stop it. You're in their face, like immediately, you see? Okay? And that's what I believe I represent, which is that every moment of every day, you have a responsibility to protect your own dignity. And it doesn't matter if you're embarrassed or you create an embarrassing situation. You protect yourself. Now, you see, when my generation arrived in college, 1964, the parietal rules were in full power. So that at Harper College, State University of New York at Binghamton, where I went to college, the girls had to sign in at 11 o'clock at night into the dorms. And the guys could run free all night long. And so it's my generation of women who said, right, we want the same treatment as men. We want the equality, okay, and freedom that men enjoy. And the colleges said, no, the world is dangerous, okay, we must protect you. We must protect you against rape. And we said, give us the freedom. Freedom is the value, not protection. Okay, so it dismays me to see young women today wanting the parent figures back, okay? Wanting the oversight, wanting to run to committees, when something goes wrong on a date. I oppose that, okay? I think it's infantilizing, and women have got to stop doing that. They have to govern their own relationships with men or with anyone else. Okay? And that is the only way women will ever become totally free and totally equal.
You compared the agrarian period with the physical effort of that era that created strength in women and men, and then going into the modern era where people became more fragile. Do you think that modern society with technology is sustainable?
Technology today has become our art form. There's no doubt, okay, that that the constant modulations and evolution of our handheld devices and so on, it's the equivalent of art forms in another society. But I am very concerned about our excessive dependency on this new virtual reality. Now, I love the web. I was in the, from the founding issue of Salon magazine. I've been part of it, et cetera. But I'm very concerned because I see a pattern from ancient history, which is when you have empires which become extremely affluent and extremely complicated, you get very complex bureaucratic structures, and everything gets so interwoven that it's very easy for the whole thing to collapse. And at the same time, you get an affluent, educated class that's extremely tolerant. Okay, that is rather hedonistic, that has no scruples about heterosexuality, homosexuality, and so on. Anything goes, et cetera. They're in the ancient Roman period, they're vacationing on Capri and Pompeii and so on. All right. So I am concerned, okay, that we're heading toward a civilization that is so complex and so dependent on other people, and particularly on electric power. All it will take is one gigantic asteroid burst that takes down the power grid, and all of a sudden mankind is going to be scrabbling back to the primitive and barbaric realm again. So I do feel some concern about the fragility of our culture and our removal from nature. And with secular humanism has also gone this cosmic vision I was talking about, right? And the lack of this larger perspective. So yes, I mean, I don't, I think there's reason, I feel I feel shadows coming, yes, okay?
You see no exit from this cycle.
Well, my theory of history is cyclic. I see a kind of organic pattern in history as in artistic styles. Things begin and, great ideas, high energy, it grows to a certain point, and then you start to get the decadence. Now, I love decadence, okay? All right? Oscar Wilde was, after all, my very first influence. But I feel like I'm a decadent at the fall of Imperial Rome. That's why I'm very interested in androgyny. That's been my subject, since I was in college, the subject of my dissertation. I consider myself transgender, okay? And I think people are starting to understand that my book, Sexual Personae, was a transgender book, okay? That it was a transgender protest against the power of nature. Finally, I think people are starting to wake up to that.
We have a common upbringing, and our fathers knew each other.
Oh.
And you're very big on extended family, clan, and tribe.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of paradigm would you see for making this relevant in the 21st century?
Well, I'm not sure that we can ever recover that tribal connectedness any longer. But I do see it still surviving for working class families much more than for upper middle class families. I noticed this, for example, when going to the New Jersey shore just to walk on the beach and so on. I see in those working class resorts of like the Wildwoods, right, how often you have multi-generations of families vacationing together. Okay, it makes me quite nostalgic. That is something that's completely gone from the upper middle class. The more affluent you are, the less likely it is that you're going to go vacation with your parents, okay, where people run off to expensive resorts in the Caribbean and so on. They're not taking, you know, the grandparents with them, right? But working class families in Fairmount Park, in Philadelphia, you know, every week you can see immigrant families still, African-American families. They'll come for a day in the park with the food, toys, football, et cetera, and it'll take some park benches, the barbecue pits, and so on. I spend the whole day there, multiple generations of a family all together for the day at the park. And every time I see that, it takes me all the way back to Endicott and to what, you know, what I remember that's lost now, okay, which is that this everyone knowing each other, the people who came from the same town in Italy, and the people grew up next to each other. You know, people didn't move. Today we're in a very transient culture where people, to get a job, will go hundreds of miles, thousands of miles far from the extended family. So what you have today, it's a great difficulty for women trying to manage a household in all also a job at the same time. The simultaneous is the collapse of the old extended family into the nuclear family. Now, what I'm saying in my work is that I think the nuclear family is toxic. This is something new, and this is what conservatives, you know, my argument with conservatives, who constantly talk about, you know, the need for a two-parent family and so on. I'm going, throughout most of human history, okay, there has never been a two-parent family. Okay, it has been a multi-generational family has raised, the children, right? Not just two. So I believe that, what we have today in America so often is like these houses lined up next to each other with a, you know, two-parent family and the children. These actually are kind of toxic cubicles for neurosis, okay? I don't necessarily think that has ever been, a healthy prescription for children, to be raised. And another thing is that, at first, women benefited enormously from the invention of all these labor-saving appliances like the automatic, you know, washer and dryer and so on, right? This saves women so much time compared to all the laborious doing of the laundry and you know, rinsing out the, you know, squeezing the water out and so on. They had these, but now today, the laundry, which used to be a communal activity with other women, has turned into an isolated, lonely thing, you know, for women. Okay, you're trapped in a house to do the laundry. And also, the higher up you rise in affluence, the less likely it is that you know the neighbors. Okay, you don't know the neighbors, all right? And even if you know the neighbors, you would never dream of saying to them, "Oh, somebody's come up. Can you just watch, you know, my two or three children? Okay, while I just run." You would never do that in a million years, okay, in an affluent neighborhood. Whereas in a working class neighborhood, people know each other, they trust each other. And also, people in working class neighborhoods, particularly in cities like South Philadelphia, are oriented toward the street. They're watching. They're sitting on the stoop. They're sitting on the porch. Okay, so there's this sense of a neighborhood that's it's like a real community of the old days. So again, I think that as people move up the economic scale in terms of affluence and power in the workplace, they're actually getting more and more neurotic because of the psychological dislocations that have not been, I think, you know, fully confronted. So I don't know exactly how to recover these things, but I do think that it's useful for women to realize how much they've lost in terms of their solidarity with other women.
I would love to hear your thoughts on the forces that allowed the rise of Mr. Trump, especially in the media.
Well, I mean, I supported Bernie Sanders. I voted eventually for the second time for Jill Stein of the Green Party and so on. I view the victory of Trump as a response to the failures of the Democratic Party to confront real problems, that are long-standing problems in the United States that the Democrats had no solutions to. I felt this coming, you know, for a very long time. I thought it was a terrible mistake to allow the DNC to push Hillary Clinton through as the nominee. I'm sorry, it's my opinion. Quite frankly, I wish that there had been younger candidates in both parties. I think it's about time for my generation, the baby boomers, you know, to get off the stage, for heaven's sakes. I wanted nominees for both parties to be younger people in their 40s or early 50s. I hope that's going to be be a great blast of energy into the political system soon. It's important for the Democrats to do, seems to me, a very clear-eyed analysis of the reasons for the loss, because there were real issues about job creation and other things. Reduction of the federal bureaucracy, it was an issue the Democrats were helpless with. Bureaucracy is, to me, you know, an octopus, a parasite, whether it's in Washington or it's on the college campuses. Bureaucrats, are automatons, okay? They are absolutely soulless. Okay? The minute you allow any entity to be run by bureaucrats, okay, we're in trouble, okay? And so the Democrats just want to add on and add on and add on, okay? This is not the way, I don't call that progressive, okay? Progressive is to deconstruct the bureaucracy. So, again, Democrats have to come up with better solutions to problems and they'll start winning again.
I would just like to ask you to talk some about the differences between men and women that you think are really important, whether they're hardwired or have developed over thousands of years, mm-hmm. in feeling, in thinking, in sex drive, in workplace, whatever you want to say about that.
Yes, I speak about biological factors and the way the mind works. For example, it's slightly satirical in chapter one of Sexual Personae, but I think I'm right, which is that boys have to learn, because of their genital anatomy, how to aim. If they don't learn how to aim, when they try to urinate, okay, they will soil themselves and the wall and everything else. They must learn to aim. And eventually that carries over into the sex act. All right? And so I talk about that, the focus and directedness, and how, you know, Freud, it talks about how primitive man preened himself on his ability to put out a fire, okay, with a stream of urine, okay. And I say, well, that's a strange thing to be proud of, but beyond the scope of any woman who would scorch her hams in the process of trying to put out a fire with a stream of urine. So I do believe, okay, that there are sexual differences. I think that as civilizations evolve, as they become more complicated, that gender eventually has a performance quality, that it becomes an artifact, like other artifacts, like works of art, but that ultimately there are very fundamental sexual differences that come from the fact that most men have 8 to 10 times the amount of testosterone in their bodies than women do. My entire life I've noticed the way men talk and think is different. I mean, heterosexual men talk and think different than the way women think. I remember my father saying he could, that when he would listen to the women talking, my mother, my aunt, and you know, all of it, he said he could never follow the conversation. Then no names were being used. And sentences weren't being ended, but yet everyone knew exactly what they were talking about. Okay, and I've noticed that myself. People will say, "Oh, did he see that? He saw that. Oh, okay. He saw that. She saw. Okay. All right. So, all right." And that's why I love the Real Housewives. Okay, it's I adore the Real Housewives. Gloria Steinem hates it. Okay, you see, but the Real Housewives absolutely records and documents the way women are in a group. Okay, now maybe not dissenting women, maybe not lesbian women. Okay, I'm just talking about heterosexual women, okay, all right, in a group. I love to be around heterosexual women talking in a group, okay, and so do a lot of gay men. That's why they're stylists and so on and so forth. Okay, there's like a weird energy, okay, that the women have with each other. Okay, it goes all the way back to the hunter-gatherer era, okay, where the women were all talking with each other around the hut while the men went off in the hunting party and had to be quiet and silent while they stalked the prey. You see, the talkative men didn't last long, okay, et cetera, all right? But, you know, at the same time, and so I do feel that, you know, that transgender people and that, you know, many gay men occupy kind of middle ground, you know, between the sexes, right? And a tremendous amount of the history of the arts, okay, it was created in that middle ground, okay, that the, you know, that the, you know, the transgender shamans, had a, you know, a vision of the universe, had an intuitive quality, you know, but it biologically speaking, every single cell of the human body, the DNA has a DNA code in it, which tells you what the actual gender of that body is. So that, I think that there's a lot of talk these days about the ability to change sex, but you cannot change sex in point of fact. You can make modifications of the body, you can take hormones that further change the appearance of the body, but ultimately, at a certain point, every single cell in the human body will continue to show that it is either male or female, except for a very tiny number of truly intersex people. And I don't know what, you know, I exactly belong to. I've never for, you know, a day in my life have I felt female. Never for a minute in my life have I felt female. But I don't feel like a man either. Okay. So, I'm willing to acknowledge, you know, that I have a gender dysphoria. Okay. And out of that gender dysphoria, I made a lot of books. Okay. My voice is the voice of a transsexual. This is absolutely true. Okay. But nevertheless, I believe, and that's why I've called my book, okay, Free Women, Free Men, that it's time to valorize, okay, the sexes. Transgender people in the middle actually gain identity from the existence of the mass of men and the mass of women. So I applaud you as a man. Okay.
Thank you so much for being bold and going into the non-PC realm and okay. Empowers people like me. I sort of grew up a Baptist Taliban, if you will, and I made the jump to libertarianism. And from my perspective, libertarianism is about empowerment. It is the party the women should be migrating to, in my opinion. In your opinion, how do we draw more women to the libertarian philosophy and explain to them that it is the party of empowerment, whereas the Democrat, progressive, the idea is sort of to replace men with the government, whereas the libertarian philosophy is to empower women and while also empowering men. So
yes.
How would we do
that? Yes, I do call myself a libertarian as well, even though I'm not really part of the Libertarian Party, at all. But yes, I think this is really true. That which you said exactly right. Okay, we cannot have a situation where women now substitute the government, okay, for the male figures upon which we used to depend, okay, for economic sustenance. I think we need many more actually parties in the United States. The problem is we have these like giant big tent parties, you know, the two, okay, which suck up, you know, all the oxygen and all the money and become a kind of porridge. There's no clear thing. But, you know, countries that have multiple parties often are very fractured. They have to form coalitions in order to govern. So I can see the difficulty, of, multiple parties in a country of our size. But there's absolutely no doubt that we need tremendous, drastic reform of the present party structure, and I think it will only come from the challenge. Okay, that's what I'm trying to develop, you know, on the Green Party too. Even though I don't necessarily agree with everything the Green Party stands for. Would you say that you, are, in terms of your economic policy as a libertarian, do you think you tend more toward conservative or capitalist or what? How do you?
I find myself to be fiscally conservative. I think that free enterprise is brought more people out of poverty than any government program, mm-hmm. and I've traveled overseas quite a bit, and I've seen that. Mm-hmm. I think that we're facing a situation where we don't have free enterprise. Mm-hmm. We have burdensome regulation and taxation that's sort of suppressing small businesses and individuals to the advantage of too big to fail corporations. We bail out the banks, we kick out the home, you know, mm-hmm. the homeowners.
Yes.
So I would say yes, I'm fiscally conservative.
Yes, I feel that what we need in, especially in the inner city, okay, in high school, is the teaching of entrepreneurship to disadvantaged youth, to show them the way the system can work. The kind of thing that comfortable middle class and upper middle class young people get from their parents who know about banking and stock investment and so on. I mean, I definitely believe in a much more jobs-oriented educational system, both at the high school and the college level. Okay, well, I think we are of the same mind. Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Be the change.
Thank you. Great. Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you very much for coming.
That was Camille Paglia, Free Women, Free Men. She spoke at the Seattle Public Central Library. Camille Paglia is the University Professor of Humanities and Media Studies at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. She's the author of many books, including Free Women, Free Men. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Vandana Shiva, Madawi Arashid, Rebecca Solnit, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Angela Davis, David Corton, Richard Wolfe, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Camille Paglia, Free Women, Free Men, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. You are listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Tave Fauché-Drake, and I'm going to be operating the board here until noon. Coming up next at 10 o'clock is Chris Andre. She hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interview, and commentary. At 10:15, we have Law and Disorder, which investigates Trump's financial ties to Russian oligarchs, plus former CIA analyst Ray McGovern explains the deep state's role in hacking during the presidential campaign. At 11, on stage and studio, D'Mae Roberts welcomes Devin Allen, who stars in the new production of Good With People at Performances Works Northwest. And then a preview of D'Mae's new documentary, Crossing East, Relations, about the historic relationship between Black and Asian Americans. And then rounding out the morning at 11:30, On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, with reports from Gerald Holm on the Manchester bombing, Libya, and the Supreme Court's voting rights decision. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Additionally, if you've heard anything today or on another day that you'd like to hear again, go to KBOO Portland/listen. Stick around.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here is an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm or stop by the station to pick